The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, folks. How you doing? For me, it's kind of the first Monday off the back of the Easter break. One of my two kids is back at school, so I feel like the end is nigh in a kind of nice way. We've had a lovely time together, but I'm definitely, I don't know, I love what I do, so I'm excited to kind of jump back into work and see what the rest of the year has in store for us. We've got lots of exciting guests coming up on the podcast over the next couple of weeks. We've got Asif Kapadia, Vincenzo Lamagna, and Sylvie Landra. So that's director, composer, and editor of this fantastic production called Creature, which is Asif's interpretation of this beautiful English National Ballet performance. And it's just a great story. So that's coming up. Dead Ringers, which is Alice Birch's take on the Cronenberg film from the 80s, stars Rachel Weisz in the lead roles. That's coming to Amazon on the 21st of April, and we've got Rachel and Alice on the show talking about it. Loads of great music in that as well. So yeah, lots of great stuff coming up for you. So yeah, it's a funny old time with regards to films. I mean, there's loads of great stuff around, loads of things on the way as well. But it's nice because we can kind of take a little bit of a breath and just kind of dive into some really exciting new things, be that celebrating things like Creature or Dead Ringers. Definitely while still encouraging you guys to get back into the cinema and make sure that you keep that afloat, because where would we be without the wonderful joys and escape of cinema in that big dark room with the sound almost pumping blood around your system? Anyway, today we're focusing on something that's been, I would say, one of the TV events of the year, and we're really excited to be able to celebrate a success with two of the composers who worked on it. Based on the 2013 video game The Last of Us, tells the story of Ellie and Joel as they navigate a post-apocalyptic world in which a mass fungal outbreak has caused humanity to collapse, with the infected turned into bloodthirsty zombie-like creatures. Now, the game was originally scored by Gustavo Santaolalla, who returns to work alongside David Fleming on the HBO show, which you can watch on Sky and Now TV. And I was very lucky to speak individually to both of them, and we'll begin with Gustavo, not least because, well, he wrote the now iconic theme tune. Thank you so much for your time. It's such a treat. Before I dive into The Last of Us, if you don't mind, I wanted to talk about a few other things, if that would be okay first. The diversity and the variety of work that you've done as a composer and creative is truly wonderful, and your storytelling through your work is extraordinary. For me, one of my favorites is Into the Wild. I adore that film. I think it's everything about it, just all the pieces, just...
Yes.
I don't know. It was such a powerful film for me, and particularly that music, you know, combination of yours and, you know, and Eddie's as well. And I wondered if we could talk about that for a minute before we dive into something else. What was it about that project that was appealing for you, that you wanted to be involved in? What was the ask?
Well, you know, I think the story was appealing, and on top of everything, the fact that it was a real story, and the idea to working with Sean too, you know, I mean, I met him through Alejandro González Iñárritu, and we hit right on immediately. And so there was all these elements that and also, as a matter of fact, the fact that Eddie was involved and Kaki King, which is another guitar player that I really like very much, which at the time I hadn't met, but it was funny because then I remember I was at a dinner in which actually she played, and then she came to me to say, "Oh man, I'm such a big fan." I said, no, I'm a big fan of yours. So there was all these elements that made it really nice for me to be a part of. You know, I'm very picky about the projects that I get involved with. So
yeah.
And usually I do things that are actually on the sort of go through the border, through the side, you know, no, I really don't belong to the sort of the Hollywood system. You know, I don't have anything against it, but it didn't happen to me to be involved in. I've always been involved with films that actually some of them, like Brokeback Mountain, you know, they were rejected by Hollywood for like 10 years. They couldn't make the film, you know. And then, you know, Motorcycle Diaries are always films. Motorcycle Diaries was a film that actually, you know, was the biggest foreign film in the United States that year, but couldn't actually be presented at the Oscars because it was financed parts by France, parts by Brazil, parts by United States. No country wanted to take that film to represent them, you know. So we got the song, you know, remember? I mean, that I produced the track. But and I got the BAFTAs for this. Well, that was my first big award, you know. Actually, I wasn't even gonna. We were not gonna go because at the time I was nominated. I've done two films at the time. I did Amores Perros, and that was my film, you know.
Wow.
And I was nominated alongside, I don't know, Howard Shore and some other people. I said, "There's no way I have, you know, a chance to do that," and you know. And then they were saying, "No, you should come." People in there, you know, in England were saying, "No, you should come. People love the movie here and they love the music. You should." So we decided with my wife and I said, okay, let's go, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember when we were coming in the theater, they were playing the music of Motorcycle Diaries. I went, oh. And the movie won Best Foreign Film and it won the music, you know. That was my very, very big first award.
And then you mentioned Brokeback Mountain and then Babel as well. You won for as well, didn't you? Yeah.
You know, after that, it wasn't really something planned. You know, there wasn't really like a master plan. Okay, I did this before because I started as a recording artist, as a singer-songwriter, I mean, with my band, as an artist and as a producer when I was 17 years old in Argentina. You know, I did my first album when I was 18 years old. And that album, which is now also re-released in vinyl and stuff, and it was not in mono. That's how far I go. Still, I think if you hear that album, it's the blueprint of my career. That album, everything. Yeah, is the music of the films, my, you know, my sort of my intentions and my concepts as a producer. You know, I'm very visual in my music. You know, so I had my fans at the time, and then I came to the States, and we went through that period of sort of adapting myself. I mean, I sort of have to come to the States at the end of the 70s because my country was in a terrible moment with a military junta, and actually 30,000 people disappeared at the hands of the government. I was in jail since I was 16 many times just for having long hair and playing an electric guitar, because I didn't belong to any political party. I didn't do any drugs, nothing. I was just, that was just something that bothers them, you know? Or either cut your hair, get in line, or else. So kind of like that. But then, you know, I became very, very well known as a producer for alternative Latin music. And I had my own label. I was very, very successful for that. I have now 19 Grammys, you know, 17 Latin Grammys and 2 Anglo Grammys, 2, you know, my Grammy. the thing that moved to the movies was very, you know, very, very unexpected. I put out a record called Ronroco, which is with my little instrument, you know, my Ronroco. And I've been playing that instrument since I was a kid too, you know, and I started collecting recordings for for years, you know, and I just showed them to my friends and stuff. I did many records, but never put that. And then I got this opportunity to produce a compilation by one of the greatest charango players. You know, the ronroco is an instrument that comes from the charango. So it'll be like between like a saxophone, a tenor, a baritone. You know, this is like a baritone, but a charango, you know? And although it sounds different because it has sustain and stuff. So I think it has its own status as an instrument. So I was called to produce this compilation for Jaime Torres. When I tried to explain people who Jaime Torres was, he's not with us anymore, but who he was kind of like a Ravi Shankar of the charango, you know? Oh, so it was a master that I always admire as a kid and stuff, you know? I met with a guy, I listened to 400 of his recordings to put together this album. And this is before we became very, very close friends. And it was my dear, dearest friends. But at the time, it was the master. And so I was dying to show him what I did, you know, with the instrument. But at the same time, I was scared because I thought I didn't play with the technique that they play, you know. I don't play long nails and I don't play with the right hand very fast. I do more picking. I can comp and play melody at the same time. So, and the music that I play is not necessary, wasn't necessary music from the Andes Mountains. It was just music that came to me, you know.
Yeah.
After, you know, a few weeks that I knew him and stuff, I gave him the music and I said, Jaime, this is something that some friends of mine do. And I didn't tell him that, you know, that it was me, you know. So he calls me like 3 days later and he says, Gustavo, you are the guy that is playing here. Come on. I said, well, you know, master, I didn't know that, you know, what you were going to say because, you know, he says, there's not rules of how do you play this instrument, you know, because true. I mean, it's a folk instrument. There's no, but at the time there weren't even books or anything about, you know, it's like a bastard instrument in a way, you know what I mean? It's not like a guitar or an oboe or a flute, you know? So he said, there's no rules, you know, you found the spirit of the instrument.
Yeah.
You
make comes a record. From within.
Yeah. You have to make a record. So I put together recordings and I recorded some more. Actually, I did a piece with him for another 6 months. And I put out Ronroco. And that album actually comprises 13 years of my life.
Wow.
Those recordings were 13 years of my life they covered, you know? So I put the record out. At the time, I had already my label with Universal, which was a joint venture, which had been very successful with alternative bands from Latin America, selling millions of records. So I knew I didn't have the time to go and promote the record and go out and stuff, more than doing some interviews on the radio and stuff, you know, but no way of a tour. But I put it out anyhow because of the music and because Jaime told me to do so. And, you know, just like that, you know, KCRW here at college, very important college station here, starts playing the record heavily, you know, and some other radios in the United States, alternative radio. And then I get one call, you know, one day we get a phone call at the studio. It's, you know, Michael Mann wants to talk to you. He wants to use a piece in The Insider, you know, from Ronroco. Yeah. Wow. And I knew what the movie was about, contemporary with the Ronroco. So I met Michael. He showed me a piece, which is a turning point in the movie. It's a feature cue. So as you know, it's more than 2 minutes with no dialogue or anything.
Yeah, it's you know?
And just worked fantastic, you know. So at the same time, you know, I had a common friend of Alejandro González Iñárritu, which I didn't know who he was, and said, you know, Gustavo, you have to do the music for Alejandro's movie. And she was telling Alejandro, Alejandro, you should meet Gustavo. So the story about Amores Perros, which is the first movie that I did, you know, is that I was very busy at the time. I'm always very multitasking. I was doing a couple of albums. I was working in some other projects. One afternoon, I was saying, man, I mean, I haven't read a script of the movie because they didn't send me. I haven't seen a rough cut. It's a first-time director. You know, I said, Lucy, you know, who's my assistant forever. He's been my assistant. I said, Lucy, call tomorrow and said, you know, say that I'm not going to be able to do this movie. I'm so, you know how busy I am now. I have to do this and deliver. I'm not going to be able to do this. You know, I haven't seen anything. I haven't read the script, anything. So, you know, it's a first-time director. Let's leave it, you know, in the future, we'll see. In the middle of the night, this is a true story. I woke up. Not bathing in sweat, but I woke up in the middle of the night and I started thinking, what if this guy is a genius? What if it's an incredible movie and I didn't get the chance to see it or anything? And then I find out the biggest mistake of my life and stuff. No, I can't say no to something like on a blind decision, you know?
Yeah.
So I called in the morning, Lucia, I say, Lucia, stop. So she called and say that if they come over to Los Angeles and they show me a movie, I might consider it. We'll see. Sure enough, Alejandro came with a movie. They put the movie in. At the time, it was a VHS, you know. he put the movie in, you know. And I was with the engineer that worked with him for many years. So he put the movie. He went out because he was a chain smoker at the time. He went out. And I don't know if you remember or if you got the chance to see Amores Perros, but the first 10 minutes of the movie, you know, when with a dog bleeding in the back, that car chase. All this stuff. And I remember, I look at Aníbal and we went, man, we're doing this movie. I don't know what we have to cancel or whatever, but we're doing this movie. And so that really made the relationship with Alejandro. Yeah. And then he says at a certain point, Alejandro said, you know, there's this friend of mine. I don't know if you know him, Walter Salles. I'm going, yes, Central Station. I love him. Well, he's doing this movie, you know, about Ernesto Guevara before he was a Che. And, you know, he is Argentinian, Guevara. So, you know, you guys should meet, you know.
Wow.
So I met Walter. We hit right off. We did a motorcycle. Thank you. Then when we were presenting Motorcycle at Sundance to get distribution in the United States, they saw the movie, you know, it was fast. For me, it was fascinating seeing how those deals were made that evening, you know, somehow. Yeah. Out dinner, and boom, the distribution was in place. Party or sort of, you know, gathering at a house. And somebody that has been in the business forever and a dear friend, Kathy Nelson, now, you know, she said, you know, Gustavo should meet Ang Lee because he's doing this movie. That's exactly how it happened, you know.
That's so amazing.
They sent me the script. I read the script. I was fascinated by the story. 2 months after that, I was in New York playing with a classical composer from Argentina, Golijov. I produced some of his stuff, and I was playing at Carnegie Hall with him, Myron Rocco. And so I was with Myron Rocco. I just finished rehearsal, and somebody calls me and say, you know, Ang is at the Focus office in Manhattan, and would like to meet you, you know. Aww. I took the subway and went there, came in with Ron Rocco. You know, that doesn't talk that much, and, you know, he pointed at the instrument, like, you know, what's that? I remember I took the instrument out and I started playing without almost no talk, you know. Then we talked. A month later, I sent the music. It was so funny because James Seamus, the producer, you know, calls me and said, oh, man, you won't believe it. I mean, you know, when Ang got the music, he thought you were sending stuff that you've done before just to show him what you do. And he said, damn, I mean, this would have been the perfect music. And he said, no, this is the music for the movie, you know. And I remember James said, well, I see you at the Oscars. And that year was after the following year to the Motorcycle Diaries BAFTA. I got nominated again at the BAFTAs, but I lost to John Williams, you know, for Memories of a Geisha.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're interested in all this that I'm telling
you. Oh, it's amazing. I love it, Gustavo. I love it. It's brilliant. You're a great storyteller.
So what happened was that we were going, as you know, here in the States, they call it the award season.
Yeah.
Because you have the Critics' Choice Award and the Director Guild Award and the actor. Well, then comes the BAFTAs, which are very important. That's when it's starting to get momentum. No, then the BAFTAs, then the Golden Globes, and the Oscars. And that's it. Then boom, you know, people sort of measure the temperature of how things are, you know, and usually when there's a movie that has a big impact, you get multiple nominations in all of those, you know. So obviously the movie and the music got nominated in all of the, and it was one after the other that was, you know, winning. John was winning all of them, including the BAFTA. So we got to the Golden Globe, and I was not only nominated by the score, but also by the song, because you know how they have these rules. The Oscar didn't thought that the amount of time that the song was on screen allow it to be nominated, yeah. You know, but the Golden Globes took it, and I lost once again the score, but I won the song, you know, yeah, that I wrote with Bernie Taupin, you know, because they asked me, who do you want to write a song? And I remember of Tumbleweed Connection, you know, I remember that album. I said, you know, it would be great to do it with Bernie Taupin, thinking, and I mean, I'm going to write a song with Bernie Taupin, you know. They show him the movie. He loved it, and he said he was so gracious and so kind.
Wow.
I only had the tag of the song, you know, which was "A Love That Will Never Grow Old." I just had that, you know. But he wrote all that beautiful, the beautiful lyrics for the song. So we suddenly I was there, you know, on stage, with Bernie getting this Golden Globe.
Go to sleep, may your sweet dreams come true. Just lay back in my arms for one more night. I've this crazy old notion that calls me sometimes, saying this one's the love of your life. 'Cause a love that will never grow old. And I know a love that will never grow old.
And then the Oscar was the Oscar, no? And I never, by then I had a lot of, I've been blessed with lots of awards, and I was at another point in my life. I was not a kid. I haven't been a kid for a long time, although I'm still a kid. But you know, I took awards just like they are awards, you know.
Yeah.
But the Oscar really, I mean, got me nervous, you know. And,
yeah, I bet.
And I used to walk through the house, my house, and said, "And the winner is John Williams." Just to when they say it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I
wasn't, you're prepared.
But I mean, yeah. You put the camera on you, and you
got to do your happy, sad face, your happy loser face.
Friday came, and I said, "Man, I mean, you can't go like this. I mean, this is ridiculous. Mm. You know, this is like the World Cup. You know, for us, you know, you know what football is for. So this is like the final. You can't go like this. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. I know you're a small team or whatever, but you know, you have to go." And if you win, you win. And if you lose, you lose. But you can't go with this attitude. So I went there. I remember I measured the theater and stuff. And it happened. And it happened.
That's such a great story.
And it happened. And you know, and it was funny because they picked Salma Hayek to read the nominees.
Oh.
And I knew that she could say my name right.
Yeah.
But actually at the Golden Globe they didn't say it. They pronounced it like if it was Italian, Santa Eulalia, you know, and it's Santa Eulalia.
I love that story. It's so interesting you're talking about how, you know, you said at the start about how you're kind of picky about what you do and what you decide to do. And
yes.
Making that choice to work back 10 years ago on The Last of Us, on the video game originally, what was the thing that made you want to jump onto that project? Because it was a completely different.
So after, as a matter of fact, I was two days ago. I had the pleasure to do an interview for my YouTube channel to Neil, you know, and he told me, he asked me the same thing, because he told me that when he proposed, they proposed him different composers, and he said, "What about Gustavo Santaolalla? I would love him to do the music," and everybody around him, you know, in the company instead, they said, "No, but he, you know." He won two Oscars. He's not going to want to do a video game, you know what I mean? And then he said, "Why do we put ourselves so low?" You know, it's like, okay. So
yeah.
whatever it is, I first of all, I've always been very interested in all media.
Yeah.
The aspect where music, where sound can be involved, I'm interested. And all sort of art forms, all sorts of genres, I don't divide them. For me, music, it's divided in good music and bad music. There's not genres, you know. So one of the things that I knew, I'm not a gamer. I'm a horrendous player, you know. But I have a son that at the time where I was approached, he was around 15 years old, you know.
Perfect.
He was a really good player, and I enjoy immensely watching him play. I would sit down and watch him play, and I had a lot of fun seeing and trying to figure out what he was doing, you know.
Yeah.
With my band, you know, with band Bajo Fondo, that I've been, you know, forever playing and touring and stuff. They play a lot of FIFA World Cup, you know, and so I watched it like if I was watching a football match on
TV. Absolutely.
But watching my son, I always thought, you know, well, you know, if somebody at some point creates an emotional connection with a gamer, aside of the combat, the survival, aside of all the fighting and all that, if somebody connects in a more emotional, deep level of human level, this is going to change the world of games as we know it, you know? And so after the two Oscars, I was approached by several companies to do video game music, you know? One very important company, we're not going to name, but there was more of the same. I said, no, I knew what this is, the picking stuff, you know? I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted. So when I met Neil and he told me the story of The Last of Us, I said, this is it. This is exactly what I had. Not zombies or not, that part I didn't know, but the emotional content. And actually he made it very clear that that was part of the intention of how the game was designed, to get the gamer involved in a personal level, you know?
Yeah.
So that was the main reason. I mean, the main reason was a great story. Meeting Neil also, I think it's very important also who's driving that story. And so it was a no brainer. I mean, I immediately knew that I wanted to be involved. That was the game that I should do. And as a matter of fact, you know, I haven't done any other games.
Yeah. And did you know instinctively as well in terms of instrumentation? Because what's been so beautiful from, I mean, I'm not a gamer at all either, but I've listened to the music a lot. And from the journey of the music from the first game to part two to then to the TV show, there's a beautiful simplicity almost to it in a way. And the choice of instrumentation, that it's got a human touch and it's got a human connection to it in a way, I think is just, it really, I don't know, drives that emotion in a way for me.
Thank you so much. I mean, some things, you know, in my work, I've been able with years to articulate in words because when I was younger, I did, and I worked with lots of elements or tools or things and gestures and stuff that I use that are part of my language and stuff, but I didn't know why I did them. You know, it was just pure instinct.
Yeah.
Now, articulate, and I go, oh, you know, I remember always when James Seamus once again, the guy in Brokeback Mountain, when I had that phone call conversation, you know, after I sent the music, that he sent, you know, I mean, those negative spaces that you use, you know, and I went, negative, what is, oh, he means the silence, you know, he said, you know, sometimes I felt that you were pulling my leg, that it wasn't, you know, like, I mean, are you joking? I mean, are you, you know, because it was so long, you know, but I like to think of those silences as eloquent silence, silences that say something, that are talking, that are playing, you know, they're playing that we put to, we fill that blank. It's an active silence. It's not a silence where that concludes, but you know, it's a silence that actually lingers and you, you know, and then that moment is like, I have also, I mean, it's a theory that I have that I think also in a way, sometimes in a way, I think that those silences can also draw more attention from the to the spectator. It's like when you hear that, you go to the front of the seat, you know?
Yeah.
You know, when is that? I don't know. Please play that note, you know?
Thank you.
And so you know, it draws your attention.
Absolutely.
You know, I think it happens the same thing regarding the playing too. I mean, one of the differences I think in my scores from other scores, and I've done scores with also with orchestras and stuff. You know, but there's always in any score, even if there's orchestras and stuff, there's always my playing. And I think the fact that I play on them, that if my playing is there, it gives another quality to it and a more personal. Several people have mentioned, including Neil and other people, that my music, you know, works almost as a character.
Absolutely.
And when I saw the first rough cut of Brokeback Mountain, it was spooky, you know, because I did, this is regarding also the way I work, because I do the music not to picture, but to the story, mm-hmm. to the connection with the characters. So it was the genius of Ang Lee to say, you know, I'm going to put this here, and we're going to repeat this. That was all Ang. But he was so courteous and nice to say at the, in the LA Times, he said, you know, that he used the music to create the narrative of the movie. So yeah. The music helped him say, okay, putting this here and this here, I can tell the story, you know, in this particular way. And so when I saw that first cut, it was spooky. There was a quality to it, you know. When I get to the video game, you know, that also was the case, because in video games, you get to see the images in movement and at the very end when everything is rendered. So you work for 2 years without seeing some drawings and what the director will tell you, the writer will tell you, right? Which is the way that I worked. So it was very organic. And when we arrived to the series, it was the same thing, because the themes were already composed. You know what I mean? It would have been ridiculous to have put, you know, new themes or new things. Because Craig Mazin, even, you know, that I've come later to the project, but now it's a big part of The Last of Us. And Neil both have said that my music is part of the DNA of The Last of Us.
Yeah.
It would have been to do The Last of Us without Ellie, you know. I mean, you can't conceive it, right? Well, the same thing is with a new theme. You know, this is not The Last of Us. So I think that personal thing, another element I think that is important is that I like to use the rough edges. You know, I compare it to painters when they put a lot of material on their canvas. You know, I like, for example, I mean, one of the normal things that any guitar player or engineer will try to do when you record a guitar is to take care of all the noises that are in between when you move your hand through the neck. I use those noises. I actually push them even louder. And I actually lived through once a director telling me, no, but I want those noises that you have, like in the Alejandro movie, where he used the noises. Noises happened because but they were just there because they were
at the moment. Well, it's you playing. It's your movement. It's your playing that then people can feel from hearing it.
Correct. And so those, I mean, I, you know, and I have a whole bunch of premises that I have in place, you know, like, you know, I work with mistakes. I love mistakes. You know, I think some mistakes are just pure mistakes, but some mistakes are really discovery of a new thing, something that you wouldn't imagine that you will do. And suddenly, you know, your mistake took you to a new world. And I explore imperfection as part of the perfection, you know.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I end up with something that is very human, extremely human. And I think that's a big difference. And the thing of, like I mentioned, about me playing it, you know, I mean, obviously there's great interpreters and there were fantastic interpreters of songs, for example. But there is something about a song when it's sung by the person that wrote it. that is very special, right? And yeah. that I think is a little bit what happens to when I feel that I'm playing. You know, I mean, when you go to a score recording, you know, they put the charts and there's a lot of people, amazing players that will never make a mistake and will never make a noise when they play. It's fantastic and it's great. And for that, I enjoy that too. But I mean, those are elements that are part of my palette. And I think that's what makes it kind of different, what I do.
I don't know if you have any intentions or not, but I would love, I mean, it'd be lovely if it was a kind of concert of your, you know, of some of your variety of your work over the years to come to the UK.
I actually was last year at Barbican.
Barbican, were you? No, I missed it.
You know, with something that people don't know, that one of the things that I consider that I'm best at more than some other things, that, you know, I think, okay, I'm good or fine, you know, but I sing, you know, that's one of my favorite things, you know. And so I actually do a journey through my life, through my music. So I start playing things that I wrote when I was 15, 17. I go through the songs and music from films, the video game. So I touch
everything.
Yeah, everything.
Oh. I promise I'm there within a second for sure.
But I'm planning, and actually I'm going to be in Europe, but not in England in the summer. I'm going to be in Spain.
Whereabouts in Europe? In Spain?
Yes.
It's not that far.
It's an experience. It's not something that you've seen or heard before. Not because I said, but because it's been said to me by many people and very people that know. It's very, very, very special. Because it's a band, we are six people, and we play like 50 instruments on stage. So we play many, many combinations of sounds and timbres, and it's all played, you know. So it's really.
I might have to plan my entire summer then around a visit to Spain to come and watch the show for sure.
I promise you won't regret it.
Oh, and Gustavo, I could chat to you all evening or all day, you know, where you are. But I know how precious your time is and how busy you are. And I hope we get the chance to do this again, because I feel like we've only really scratched the surface. And I think what's wonderful as well is I was talking about this the other day with The Last of Us. It's such an interesting project. You know, you had this game, now there's this fantastic series that's just finished here in the UK, and you don't have to be a gamer to get it, but it also gives the gamers something else. This drama that's been created is so fantastic, because, you know, my son, who is about to become 15, knew everything about the game when we started watching the series, but he still got more from watching this beautiful drama.
And the good thing about it is that, you know, gamers would have been, it was a big risk. Like, oh no, this is not. I think the music play a big role. Neil told me that the other day. He said, you know, one of the big mistakes that they've done before is one of the things, the many things, is that they change the music sometimes when they have to move from the video game to the thing. But also, you know, I said, Neil, also is a story, because I wrote the music not to a video game. I wrote the music to a great story. If there is something that I would like to add, so you have a little bit more of something that probably is good for you to know, is one of the things that I could articulate more, and it was just pure instinct, was that I kind of divided the sounds in the game, you know, in the a feminine aspect of it and a more masculine aspect of it, and really the ronroco really represent the feminine side, you know. That doesn't mean that every time that Ellie will appear with her own rock sound, you know what I mean? But just the more abstract.
Yeah.
And the, use a Fender 6 bass from the, you know, it's a vintage bass, you know, that actually is like a lower, it's an octave lower guitar. So it's not like a baritone guitar, yeah. And it's not like with another string. It's a particular instrument. And in the second installment, you know, I brought the banjo, sort of like a neutral Americana thing in between those two worlds. And I kept the ronroco. And I also brought a classical guitar that is an octave lower. Too, with these strings. So that I thought perhaps this is something interesting to have.
It is. And then also what's great is you have these kind of episodes, like episode 3, Long, Long Time, you know, which is this beautiful kind of almost standalone moment that's almost, you know, and so many people have commented on that particular episode and how just gorgeous and exquisite it is, you know, to kind of almost just take a moment out of the journey that we're on with Ellie and Joe. But that episode is stunning.
It's amazing. And also has a beautiful piece by Max Richter, which I'm a huge fan. And probably you know this because you've been writing about movies, you know, so you know that when directors are in love with a piece of music, there's nothing, you know. So I resisted, you know, to say, no, man, I mean, this is part of that. I'm a huge fan also. Yeah. No, it's been this whole project has been something really special. I mean, if you think about my career, you know that at this point, you know, I get, you know, another big round because if it got me to this new audience of 13, 14, 15 year old kids that are devoted to the music, you know, now with this opening, with a series that people actually love the story and the series, some people that perhaps even don't like video games, you know, that. The story of that now it's really universal. So hopefully I could do a world tour, you know, playing this music.
Well, listen, hopefully we can chat again around
so much
second season. It's so lovely to chat to you. It really, really is. Thank you so much for your time. And I'll see you in Spain.
Hey, please. You take care.
Take care, Gustavo. Thank you. Bye. From a score to the original game of The Last of Us, that's all gone. Rounding off the first part of this episode of Soundtracking with Gustavo Santaolalla. Now it's the turn of David Fleming, who was brought in to provide some of the tension and action cues for the TV show, including this one.
David, how are you?
Hi, Edith. I'm good. How are you?
I'm really, really great. Thank you so much. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
I'm a fan of your podcast. I really like it.
I mean, it's great timing because I literally watched the last episode of this season for The Last of Us last night. Oh, it's so great. I love this show so much. What was it like working on it in terms of, you know, in terms of that history that the story and the narrative's got really in? If you don't mind just kind of talking through your whole kind of journey with it, really would be great.
Well, I mean, the first thing I should admit is the first thing I admitted to the filmmakers, which is that I had not played the game before I started working on it. But I did know some of Gustavo's music. And when I was approached by HBO and Craig and Neil, the showrunners, I think, you know, they were really smart about being very respectful of the source material and really deferential because it's such a special story and it's touched so many people. But at the same time, I think they were also clever about what they knew they had to adapt, especially because it's a different medium. For me, what fell on my plate was some of these things that had to change for the new medium, specifically like a lot of the action sequences where, you know, in the game, if you're in an action sequence, usually the music is loopable and it's up to the player how fast or slow the scene goes. And now we're dealing with a television show which has a narrative drive. So a lot of what I was responsible for were those sequences. I mean, so much of the rest of the show, they could use Gustavo's amazing music that was all based on what he had done in the game. But I got to come in. And in some ways, it was really good that I hadn't had a history with the game, because as one of these newer elements, I could experience this TV show as a story for the first time. And in that way, sort of be respectful to the original, but also, you know, hopefully bring a new layer for the new medium.
And I think a lot of that as well is the kind of the human emotion side of it, isn't mm-hmm. it? It's the relationships. Because, you know, as much as the immersive experience of the game is, and I'm not a gamer really, and I haven't played the game, although my 14-year-old knew the whole story before we started watching it together. And I was like, don't spoil it! But it was quite interesting actually being on the journey with him, because he was clearly looking out for certain things along the way to see whether it featured or not as well, but was really, really completely blown away by, I think, particularly the casting and these characters and the connection that they had and the performances that they brought to these characters. I just think that there was, I mean, it's one of those weird things, isn't it, where you watch a show and you kind of go, it couldn't be anyone else now. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of thing, because they've fully kind of just, even though these characters have been around, they've given them something else. They've given them a whole different dimension in a way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think they really nailed the casting. And also, again, it speaks to realizing what is so special about the game. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's something about that game that touches the players who've been immersed in that world really, really deeply. And it's about the characters and about their relationship and the story. And since I started working on the show, I started playing the game and was just really blown away by how much of that emotional blueprint is there if you choose to follow it. And I think obviously having Neil as part of the team, you know, someone so close to the story, and Gustavo, and then Craig being able to adapt this to this medium and really pay attention to what is special, because you don't want it to be a quote unquote zombie show. You know, you want it to really be a drama where you believe in these characters. And I think Craig, and I know, you know, one thing we spoke about early on was we want the audience to feel really immersed in this. One of the special things about video games, I think, is that it's by its nature an active experience, that you mm-hmm. are sort of naturally immersed in it. And I think the goal with the show, my goal certainly, and the showrunners, was let's not make this a passive experience. Let's also make this feel like you're a part of this. And when Joel and Ellie are in trouble, you want to feel you're in trouble. When they are emotional, you want to feel the same emotions. So I think the cast, the crew, everyone was really deferential to what was so special about that source material, and then brought something, you know, brought one additional layer to it that just elevated it.
So many of the elements of different episodes have connected with people, but there's one particular episode that really just kind of, it reached out to people in a way that I think has been so, so beautiful, you know, and I know that the characters, did they feature in the game? You know, the episode I'm talking, was it episode 3, wasn't it? I've kind of lost my train of thought.
Absolutely. They did feature in the game, but not in that deep a way. I think it was sort of tangential, you know, their sort of backstory of Bill. And again, one of the really genius parts to expand and really delve into. I always, you know, thought of the title of the show, you know, The Last of Us, you know, it, obviously it centers around Joel and Ellie, but I love how the show, and I know the game did this as well, but the show especially centers on other stories than Joel and
Ellie.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it could be them with another character. So it could be Joel with his brother. It could be, you know, Ellie with her, with that gorgeous episode in the mall, that you're so right. It kind of can really relate to all manner of characters. How involved were you in that episode 3?
The least of all the episodes, I'm sorry to say.
No!
It's my favorite episode. No, I said the same thing. I said to Craig and one of the producers of just like, guys, I know this is not my episode, but this is my favorite. There's a couple scenes in there, but really by its nature, it was so much more a small character piece. Whereas I was responsible for some of the bigger set pieces when things go really haywire. But beautiful episode, and I even the parts I wasn't involved in, I've loved watching and been able to enjoy.
How do you know what you're writing for then with something like this? Because, you know, like you say, there's an existing kind of foundation there, you know, in terms of what Gustav's done with the game and things and what's coming forward with that. But then also, I mean, there are some absolutely extraordinary moments that you've created for the show. Talk me a little bit, if you don't mind, talking a little bit how you, you know, kind of navigate that. Is it to script? Is it to performance? Is it to both? Yeah. How did it work?
Well, I came in relatively late to the show, so most of the episodes were already in pretty good shape. And so it was kind of a pleasure to see where they were and not have to imagine too much about it.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I'm an admirer of Gustavo's music. Like I said, I knew some of his music for this game without knowing the game itself. And I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do sonically. Obviously, a lot of the scenes I've done are these big action set pieces or tension cues where it's not necessarily based on any thematic material of Gustavo's, but I wanted it to feel like the same world, and a lot of it sort of in this post-apocalyptic, starting from scratch setting in a way. So for me, it was really important that even when it was electronic, even when it was aggressive, that it had organic sources. And if we were using a drum, I didn't want it to be any drum. I didn't want it to sound like 30 drummers in a big hall with big taikos. I wanted it to sound like one drummer with one shit drum and mic'd through an amp and just rusty and broken. And so as much as possible, I wanted to evoke that sort of broken quality of the world that I think, you know, they were so good about capturing with the design of the show. Again, while it's not directly referencing Gustavo's music, I wanted it to be able to sit next to his and not feel like it was from another world, but really feel it was somehow attached or the darker cousin to what he's done. Because in a way, I think what he's done is made beauty out of the broken things as well. You know, it's like after everything is gone and you have to start from scratch, you know, what does that world sound like? a lot of it was that. A lot of it was also talking to Craig, who had a really specific idea about how he wanted the music to feel. Again, he wanted it to feel very immersive. So it wasn't about, he wanted the audience to have a very active experience and engagement with the tension scenes, especially. So, you know, right off the bat, it was like, I don't want to be humming a tune when I should feel in danger. You know, I want to feel like I am in their bodies. And so, you know, it was an interesting sort of practice of being self-restrictive musically.
Yeah.
And then seeing, well, what can we do sonically, you know, having given ourselves those restrictions.
An easy journey to kind of get to that kind of sonic plane, or was it a, you know, kind of trial and error and trying out different things?
Like I said, I had a really good idea of what would work, and I had a really good barometer of what was appropriate and what wasn't. The first scene I did was for the second episode, actually, where they're hiding from the clickers, and it kind of, the way that scene progresses and gets very intense, but also has these moments of quiet was sort of a good canvas to try and come up with a sound for.
Yeah.
And then in addition, I had some friends help with sound design, and I gave them the whole spiel of, listen, it's all rust and crappy drums and crappy metal, and let's go through amps when we can. I don't want anything to sound like it came from a computer. And then it was just sort of off to the races, and it was just using your sort of good taste barometer to try to stay within those lanes.
Fits in so well, because I think that's, I mean, there's so much about the show that I really enjoyed, and it's those moments almost where through Ellie's eyes, you know, her kind of lack of life experience, really, she really comes to things with a kind of beautiful naivety almost kind of thing, or almost a kind of blank canvas type thing. And sometimes that could be like simple things of like the type of car or a radio or, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that for, you know, the way that you're talking about the kind of instrumentation, it kind of feels like there's a lovely pull through to that almost in a way, in terms of it could almost be kind of Ellie's perspective in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want it to feel new to the audience while also obvious, you know, if you think about it, the audience is a perfect mixture of Joel and Ellie, because we know the world as it is.
Yeah.
We're also experiencing this world as it could be. I mean, hopefully not, but, you know, what would that be like if everything had to be reset in this way? So I think that's a really good point and a really good perspective to see the show through.
And the landscapes as well. I mean, you know, it's kind of that thing going, oh my God, this would be horrendous. But actually there's some really nice moments where you kind of, you know, the serenity and the peace and quiet of walking through these. I mean, there's sometimes those scenes of the cityscapes that are kind of overgrown with vegetation and things are kind of, they're absolutely gorgeous. And then those kind of vast forests and, you know, all, I mean, it's just beautiful to look at as well. And I wondered whether those, that kind of environmental sort of nature of things was inspirational to you as well for certain cues, you know, where they are. And, because sometimes you forget that they're actually escaping things because they're on a great road trip part of the time.
It is really true. I mean, there's something, it's not all, obviously the situation is horrific. I wouldn't want to be in the situation, but there is something beautiful about all of it. I mean, I remember before I was working on the show, we were watching some, me and my wife were watching some special about sort of if there was, you know, an apocalypse and how quickly plants and fungus would break things down. And there was something relieving about it in a funny way. To if the worst were to happen, that life does go on figure out how to reset.
Folks, the synthesis is still happening and Mother Nature is still around.
Exactly. But no, I think it did inspire, you know, that quest back towards the organic and not wanting to overproduce and overhype and everything. So, you know, things can still sound big when the sources are small. And I think that was the goal. And also, I should say, you know, one thing I forgot to mention is Gustavo's, some of his instruments also provided kind of a jumping off point. Like for instance, and I know in the second game he was playing, he sort of added banjo to the palette, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I had this banjo that was just sitting there. You know, I've worked alongside Hans Zimmer for a number of years, and he has a quote. I'm not sure if it's his, but he said it before. the definition of a gentleman is someone who knows how to play banjo but refrains. And I think I went the opposite way because I don't know how to play banjo at all. And I was like, this is the perfect time to pick it up, and just started mangling it. And there's something uniquely American about the banjo. And obviously it has so many connotations, but when you bow it in a certain way and sort of release sounds that are not typical from it, it can be really frightening, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if Gustavo meant to inspire me in that way, but...
The banjo, I think of Billy Connolly, who I don't know if you're aware of Billy Connolly, the great Scottish comedian.
Of course, yeah.
And prior to being, you know, when he first started, he's a great musician. He's a great banjo player. And he used to do this kind of combination of stand-up and banjo playing and stuff. So whenever I think of a banjo, I always,
that's funny.
Makes me smile, think of Billy Connolly.
I didn't know, you know, I've been aware of his comedy. I didn't know about the banjo, but, you know, Steve Martin, also a comedian with a banjo, so there's some connection there.
Billy Connolly released loads of albums, like back in the kind of early 70s of his banjo playing and stuff. So if you're on a banjo trip, David, you should head down the Billy Connolly route. Maybe
I think I need a short break.
Then
maybe I can re-engage. Yeah.
I mean, is that part of the joy of creating? I guess is that exploration into instruments and using them differently, or finding sounds, getting things, something new out of an instrument, or finding a connection that it has with a character, with an emotion, with a place. Is that part of what you love about what you do?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, even in situations where it wasn't so restricted musically or thematically, finding a sonic identity is one of the things that is most fun to me.
Mm-hmm.
I love writing for orchestra. I love doing electronic music, but all of those things are just, to me, they're just like colors in a box, and you can use them or not use them. And I think it's so important to key into what makes a story special and what makes it unique. And if you have something that feels natural to the world that you're watching or derived from it, I just think it really gives you the possibility of pulling someone into your music and then affecting them emotionally from there. It's one of the most fun things, and never more so than on this project, where the world is so frightening, but so beautiful and really feels it needs to be described in a unique way, you know?
I think another great example of that and a score that you worked on was Dune, to be honest, you know, in terms of kind of world creating through sound.
It's one of the things I love best about working with Hans, because, you know, it's never let's do the typical thing and call it a day. It's what is special about this place we're describing, you know. Of course, you know, you want musical themes that connect people to your characters, but also, why leave those other crayons on the table? You know, why just go to the same colors every time? It's such a fun thing to really dive in and get way above your head, you know, with instruments you've never used or don't know how to play, and just see what comes out. Because, you know, if it can be surprising for you, then hopefully it'll be surprising for an audience as well.
Yeah. What made you want to work in film composing?
Well, there was a lot growing up. I worked in a video store all through my adolescence, and you know, I was playing in bands, but I was always connecting with music and film. And a friend asked me to score like a little short thing, and it was just one of those times when time disappears and you just get sucked into it, and it never seemed like much of a choice, really. I would say the other element of it is my mother's a literature teacher, and it was always story, sort of ingrained in me from a young age. I think some people sort of get into this because they feel like it's an outlet for music. For me, music is my way into storytelling, and that's really what I connect with, and it's why working with good stories is so important for what I do and so inspiring.
That's so interesting, because I do think there's so many journeys into the world of composing for film and TV. Gone are the days where kind of, you know, TV, the landscape of TV is on even keels with film, you know, more so now than ever, just in terms of how wonderfully committed the production companies and the TVs, the streamers or whoever it is are to making these brilliant productions. You know, it's wonderful. It just gives, I don't know. And for you, in terms of having those two worlds kind of running, of feature film, but also, you know, TV work as well. It was funny. I spoke to Carter Burwell, and he was talking about working on The Morning Show. And he was kind of like, I didn't realize it was so much work. He was kind of like, oh, wow, there's a lot of it. Which was so lovely and kind of just so honest of him as well to say, you know, in terms of someone of that kind of stature and the work that he's done in film. And it was kind of like, it was a lot of work.
That's definitely relieving to hear him say that. Yeah.
but for you, what is it that appeals to you when projects are are around and there's an opportunity for you to work on something, what are you, is the storytelling the part of it? Is it the filmmaker? Is it the collaboration? Or is it a whole number of things?
Oh, it's all those things. I mean, the filmmaker is hugely important, but I think that the filmmaker really informs the storytelling. Like, you know, what you're saying about television is true. And I think in some ways, you know, television, the sort of episodic structure has allowed storytelling to, you know, visual storytelling to go back to being a little more novelistic, where you can really spend time with characters.
Yeah.
Which in a fun way, I think, is what connects people to video games as well, is they're spending a huge amount of time immersed with these characters. And sometimes a movie, especially if it's like a frantically paced movie, you can feel like, well, I don't know what just happened, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a filmmaker like Denis with Dune, he also changes the pace and mm-hmm. says, like, let's not just blow through all this stuff. I think if you think about, you know, what you're doing with podcasts and how people are consuming things, yes, attention spans are low, but also people want to be immersed for longer periods of time when they're enjoying something.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think that there's a real kind of, there's a laziness of people to assume that people are just interested in kind of short form, sharp bursts of things. I think that people, there's a real hunger out there for, you know, in-depth conversations. That's why I've been so kind of beautifully surprised at the response we get to this podcast. It's, you know, it's quite niche. It's quite kind of in-depth at times about kind of knowledgeable stuff about film, even though I'm coming to it as a fan. But I think you're so right. There's a real hunger for knowledge, I think is what it is.
And it is that depth. People want to believe that there's something behind what they're watching, or they want to feel there is this life under the surface of the quick entertainment, you know, or at least I'd like to think so. It seems that's what connects with people. So I think that comes all from the filmmaker. And if you have a good story, if you have something like Last of Us, where someone is clearly respecting these characters and saying, we're not just going to blow through the story, we're not going to treat this as a typical video game adaptation, you know, people believe in these characters, people believe in this story, and so let's spend some time with them. And I think it's so lovely to experience entertainment that way, as something with real depth that you want. I can't remember who said this, but you know, I think maybe it was Roger Ebert, about a good movie never being long enough and a bad movie never being short enough. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
If you have something good, that's worth diving deep.
Totally. I felt like that at the end of June. I was kind of like, no! No, it's just like, ah! Like, literally, I think I shouted at the screen because I was like, ah! Oh, just didn't want it to end. I just wanted to be in that world with those characters and just kind of get over that sand dune and see what's next.
See what's next.
Yeah. Well,
there's more coming, so you know.
Are you working on it?
I think so. I think that's the plan. I haven't seen or heard much thus far, but these things they show up and when you get that call from Hans and he says, you want to do something fun, you know, it's there's always something interesting after that initial sentence. So we'll see. You know, filmmakers like Denis, filmmakers like Craig and Neil, it's just like any chance you get to work with people who really respect quality and want to create that emotional connection. It's like, why the hell not? You know, it's always going to be a rewarding experience.
I think Han needs to have his own theme park. which would have kind of, you know, like in Disney, where it's kind of like, you know, the Magic Kingdom and Epcot and all that kind of stuff. It would be kind of all the worlds, some of the worlds that Hans created. Yeah, it'd be so great. That's just, I'm going to throw that his way next time I get the honor of chatting to him.
As long as it's based on the films that he scores and not the actual life of the film composer, I don't think that would be real right. I don't know if that's ready for the theme park adaptation.
Oh, it's the weird thing, the media and the way that they kind of, the, they're kind of almost the last episode of this season of The Last of Us went out, and then suddenly there's kind of press about season two. And it's like, guys, just let us have a moment to have a conversation about this amazing series and maybe rewatch it again and talk about it and stuff. And then, yeah, let us digest it before you start kind of telling us what we need to think about season two before anything's even, it's crazy.
I know. That is the sort of the flip side of the coin of people really wanting to spend time with characters, is that they also want the next thing right away. I mean, I'm doing that with Succession right now. I'm realizing that this next season's going to be the last, and I've got to enjoy it while it's still on. So yeah, it's that thing of when your friend gets engaged and people start saying, "Oh, when, you know, when's
when
the
are
wedding?
You having a baby?
You're having a baby." Just slow the pace. Everything is better if you slow the pace a little bit and enjoy it. But it is exciting, and it's great that what was nice to see with this show in particular was that the strategy of being true to the game seems to have paid off, in that it's not just video game fans who like the show. It really appealed to everyone, and I think in fact drove up sales of the original video game. So I think it really speaks to them doing something right with the show, and that people are that enthusiastic about wanting to see what's next in the story. And so I do understand the impatience at the same time. But
will
yeah,
you be working
I agree.
On it?
I hope so. You know, it was such a pleasure working with these guys and Gustavo, who I finally met after we were done with the show.
Oh, that's great.
I really admire him and I'd love to work with him again. And yeah, it's just sometimes when you finish a project, it can feel like a giant relief.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can feel like you felt at the end of Dune, like, oh, can't this just keep going? You know, yeah. And that's definitely how this one felt. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
What is next? What can we hear your creativity on next?
I'm doing a score for Netflix for a fantasy film called Damsel with Millie Bobby Brown, which is a complete left turn 180 from Last of Us, orchestral fantasy epic. And
right, but it's like the diversity of stuff that you've kind of worked in, that's the kind of beauty, and I guess where you want to be as a composer anyway, isn't it, is that you kind of get to, you know, you get to do things like Last of Us or Dune or Blue Planet, you know, that kind of stuff as well. It's sort of, you know, it's what excites you and what gives you the opportunity of everything we've talked about tonight.
Yeah, I've been conflicted about that my whole life. I think especially, you know, when you grow up playing in bands and everything is like, well, what's your sound, you know? What's the sound? And it always seemed so oppressive to me. And one of the things I really love about what I do is just being thrown in the deep end. I just finished this score for this sort of new Western called Americana, and sort of did like a Johnny Cash by way of Morricone thing, and you know, nice. Recorded pedal steel guitar, which I had no experience with, but now I know all, you know, at least I've taken a crash course in pedal steel, and the director Tony is like fully immersed in country Western music, and just spending time going through playlists with him, I've got like all these new, or not new, they're mostly old country artists that I'm like in love with now. So it's not like we do it for the education, but I think that especially if you're a musician and you're basically stuck in a studio most of the time, isn't it nice to be able to explore new worlds all the time?
Yeah.
And I quite like that element of it. And it seems like everything in our conversation comes back to
the banjo.
but being really finding value in being deeply immersed in something, it's like if you, whether it's the banjo, whether it's country music or bluegrass or whatever, if you have no experience in it, you can sort of write it off in a way, or say I think I know what that is, and put it in this corner of your head and say, I don't need to visit there. But then if you really take a dive and you go along willingly, you can find all this stuff that you never thought you would connect with. You never thought, you know, like the pedal steel guitar, you know, if you think about like modern country music, I know we're fully in the country music train now. If you think about modern country music,
I'll just get my stats and give me 1 second.
A lot of the sound, you could say it's top 40 with like a little pedal steel in the background, a little more twang in the voice, the lyrics are, but when you're sitting in a room with somebody who knows how to play that instrument, it's the most beautiful thing, and you encounter it in a completely different way. I think it really does require a very fundamental humbling of yourself to say, I want to experience something that I'm not comfortable with, or I
don't know anything about,
or I thought I knew something about, you know. So I think at least for now, or on my sort of musical journey thus far, it's been being thrown in a lot of deep ends of pools, and there's panic, yes, of course, when you get thrown, but it's always fun figuring out your way out of it. And to me, it's more of the fun rather than going back to the well, you know?
Oh, that's such a lovely way to put it, David. That's so great. Listen, I've kept you for so long tonight. I'm so grateful for your time. It's been such a treat to chat to you, and I hope we get to do it again. But yeah, thank you so much for your time and just being so open and chatting with me tonight. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. The pleasure's all mine.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
All right. You too.
Bye. Bye. Score to The Last of Us, that's Survive by David Fleming, rounding off this soundtracking double header. My huge thanks to David and Gustavo for taking the time to talk to me. You can watch series one of The Last of Us on Sky or Now TV. Now, I've spoken to various people discussed during this episode on the podcast, including Ang Lee, and you can find that chat at edithbowman.com, along with every other one we've done over the last 6 or 7 years. If you can, please do follow us on socials. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do also subscribe to our YouTube channel for loads of bonus video content. I have stuck loads up there over the last couple of weeks. Diego Luna is up there. James Cameron is up there. I'm going to stick Gustavo up there as well today. So please do go and check that out. Next up, we thought we'd give you a couple of days to dive into Dead Ringers, which hits Amazon on the 21st of April, so that's this coming Friday. And next Monday, you're going to hear from the showrunner and writer, Alice Birch, who also has worked on the likes of Succession. She wrote Normal People as well. She did the adaptation of Normal People. And its star, the fabulous Rachel Weisz, who also takes on the role of executive producer on the show Dead Ringers. Rachel Weisz and Alice Birch, next week's guests on Soundtrack, and I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.